WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush's greatest period of popularity resulted from his leadership during the Gulf War, and he has pointed to his foreign policy skills as one of his greatest assets. Now, newly uncovered secret documents reveal the Bush administration pursued a pro-Iraq policy before the war, in spite of warnings that Iraq was building an arsenal of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The latest development in this story shows the Bush administration may have tried to cover up policy blunders by withholding documents requested in an investigation of bank loans to Iraq. My guest, Douglas Franz, is one of the first reporters to write about the so-called Iraqgate story. He's been investigating the story for close to a year for the Los Angeles Times, often working with reporter Murray Wass. We invited Franz to bring us up to date on the story. In an interview earlier today, I asked who was warning the Bush administration about Iraq's growing arsenal.
Virtually anyone who was watching Iraq from an intelligence perspective was warning. The first warnings actually came in late January of 1989, when this was just a brand new administration, and intelligence officials briefed congressional committees on background about Libya initially, but they also raised alarms in January of 89 about Iraq's ambitious nuclear weapons program. And from that period forward, Terry, the intelligence warnings flowed fairly regularly from the Central Intelligence Agency, from the Defense Intelligence Agency at the Pentagon, from State Department intelligence sources, from the Energy Department here, where as early as April of 1989, U.S. companies complained to the Energy Department that Iraqi agents were trying to buy nuclear weapons technology from U.S. firms. And that litany or series of warnings continued unabated and basically ignored by the Bush administration.
And we know this because of secret documents that have been released?
Yes. I mean, some of them have been released. Others have been secured and written about by Murray Wass and I in the Los Angeles Times. But these are the administration's own words. I think that's why it's been so difficult for them to confront this story, because what our stories have been based on, and most stories in other newspapers have been based on, are the administration's own internal documents. These warnings have been written about extensively now, and it's very difficult to counter them. The administration's sort of line of defense in the last couple of weeks has been that the warnings were few and thin, and they really weren't worth jeopardizing our limited, they say, relationship with Iraq.
Who was advising the president to proceed in this tilt toward Iraq while others were advising not to?
Well, I think the primary players who were advising the president were Secretary of State James Baker. We've seen his name on numerous memos. He got these warnings, the intelligence warnings from the CIA and the DIA and the Energy Department, and yet he continued to push this pro-Iraq policy. And also members of the National Security Council staff at the White House. That's the organization that really provides coordinated national security and foreign policy advice to the president, and they were pushing very hard to continue this pro-Iraq tilt. Their explanation is now that they were helping Saddam in a moderate way in an attempt to bring him into, as the president says, the family of nations.
So on the one hand, you have some people advising the president to continue this pro-Iraq policy, while others warned that Iraq was building its chemical, nuclear, biological arsenal. What were the reasons for strengthening the policy with Iraq?
Well, for expanding the ties, the President Bush has explained on several occasions when he's been forced to confront questions stemming from this foreign policy issue. He said that we did it to try and bring Saddam Hussein into the family of nations. We were trying to moderate his behavior by offering limited economic incentives and selling him limited amounts of high technology. In fact, I think what the documents have shown that have emerged over the last several months, Terry, is that this was more than limited economic aid. We sent over $5 billion worth of loan guarantees to Iraq between 1983 and 1990, which freed up another $5 billion in hard Iraqi currency so they could spend it on the weapons programs. We've seen evidence, not not proof yet, but evidence that some of that, those loan guarantees which were to buy American food products, in fact were used by Iraq to buy weapons. So I think it's difficult to cast that as a limited policy. We've also seen many other instances where U.S. technology given granted export licenses by the Bush administration and earlier the Reagan administration were used by Iraq in its efforts to develop chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and ballistic missiles to deliver them.
I want to get back to these loan guarantees a little bit later. There was a memo to James Baker in 1989 from the CIA warning about Iraq's advancing nuclear missile programs. After that memo to Baker, President Bush signed a top-secret order mandating closer economic and political relations with Baghdad. Can we assume President Bush knew about that memo, or is that still in question?
That's a really interesting question. I think the extent of President Bush's knowledge at the moment he signed National Security Directive 26 is still a matter that needs to be sorted out. Murray Wass and I have followed the trail of these intelligence memos. We've seen distribution lists, and we've been told who saw them, and we follow the trail, and it stops right outside the Oval Office. Now, that's not necessarily unusual. You know, what is unusual, I guess, is that we've been able to track this material that far. But, you know, it's unclear at this point what the president knew when he signed that. It is very clear what James Baker knew about Iraq's attempts to build nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction at the time he advised the president to sign that order. And that order is a very important, in fact, a crucial juncture in U.S.-Iraq relations, because when it was issued on October 2nd, 1989, there was a great debate within the administration over continuing these loan guarantees that we're discussing. The Italian bank in Atlanta had been discovered to be loaning $5 billion to Iraq in hidden illegal loans, some of that guaranteed by the United States government. There were questions about Iraqi involvement in irregularities. There was a big movement to stop the sending that money over to Iraq because of these suspicions of irregularities. But NSD 26 was the broom that swept aside all of those objections. It was cited on numerous times by Baker and the NSC and the other State Department officials to override objections to continuing this aid to Iraq. And in fact, NSD became the broom that swept aside all those problems.
You say that the most damning memo that has recently come to light was written by President Bush just days before Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And this was a memo from Bush to Saddam Hussein. And he wrote, "Let me reassure you that my administration continues to desire better relations with Iraq. We will also continue to support our other friends in the region." How does this revise the Gulf War story?
Well, I think this requires a major revision. If you'll remember, Terry, or if your listeners will remember, shortly after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, Iraq-ish released a transcript of a conversation between Saddam Hussein and April Glaspie, who had been the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. That conversation was on July 25th, 1990, and in that conversation, April Glaspie delivered a very sort of weak warning to Saddam, and she was criticized enormously in Congress for not strongly and bluntly telling Hussein that he better not go into Kuwait or the United States would come down with him with the full weight of its military might. In fact, what we see in this secret cable from President Bush directly to Saddam Hussein, written 3 days later, is that President Bush adopted the very same attitude. It was a measure of cautious warning coupled with a measure of very obvious appeasement. Again, let me assure you, as you read, that we desire better relations with Iraq, and we will continue, however, to support our friends. At that time, there were 35,000 Iraqi troops massed on the border of Kuwait. It was a fairly obvious military threat. And nowhere in that two-page cable from Bush to Hussein is the word Kuwait even mentioned.
My guest is Douglas Franz, who's been investigating the Iraqgate story for the Los Angeles Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Franz. He's an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times, where he's been covering the so-called Iraqgate story for the past year, and he has broken many parts of this story and was probably the first reporter on it. Let's look at some of the latest developments in the story, which you've already touched on, but let's flesh this out. The Senate Intelligence Committee is now investigating illegal loans to Iraq that were made by a bank branch in America in the years before the war. The loans were made by the Atlanta branch of an Italian bank. What were the loans and why were they illegal?
Well, that's a good question. This is a most confusing and
murky
affair.
Yeah, it sure
affair.
Is. Yeah.
It's the bank is Italy's largest bank. It's Banca Nazionale del Lavoro. It's owned by the Italian government. And between 1985 and 1989, the tiny Atlanta branch of this bank made $5 billion worth of loans to Iraq. The U.S. government, in indicting six employees of the Atlanta branch, said that they were solely responsible for those loans, and they were masterminded by Chris Dragul, the branch manager down there, without the knowledge of bank officials in Rome and without reporting them as required to U.S. and Georgia banking regulators. That's what makes them illegal. What makes them illicit, if you will, is that a lot of those loans, it turns out, were used to buy specific weapons and weapons technology to build up Iraq's military arsenal before the war. For instance, in April of 1989, Christopher Dragul was in Baghdad visiting his customers, and he toured a weapons plant where he was shown Scud missiles that were being enhanced, and he was told, see, this is what your loans are helping us do.
Now, the CIA withheld documents about these bank loans, and the CIA says that the Justice Department asked the CIA to withhold the documents. So now there's a big feud between the CIA and the Justice Department about who did what. What were the documents?
The documents, as far as I know, were four cables from the CIA station chief in Rome back to the agency headquarters in Langley, in which the station chief quoted four separate, generally reliable sources, as this was in September and October of 1989, saying that BNL Rome officials were aware of the Atlanta loan activity when it was going on. Now, these cables are important, Terry, because they go in an opposite direction from the government's case. The U.S. government case says that this activity was contained in Atlanta, unknown to BNL officials in Rome. What these cables do is raise strong suspicions that, in fact, BNL officials in Rome were aware of this activity. If they were aware of that activity, it does two things. One, it removes a large part of the government's indictment of these Atlanta officials, because much of that indictment claims that they defrauded their home office bank. Now, they can't defraud a bank if the bank was aware of the loans. But second, if this trail had been followed up into the upper reaches of BNL Rome, it would have been politically embarrassing for the Italian government. And one of the theories is that had the Italian government been embarrassed, they might in turn have attacked the Bush administration by saying, we were just following the Bush administration's orders to help Iraq here. This was another wink and a nod policy of the Bush administration. Now, there's not much proof for that last theory, Terry, although we've quoted numerous State Department cables which show that the Italian ambassador to the United States and BNL bank officials from Rome applied enormous pressure on the State Department and the Justice Department to restrict this investigation and keep it from going at Rome. And in fact, they didn't go at Rome. It emerged during Dragul's three-week sentencing hearing down in Atlanta last month that the investigators were blocked by the Justice Department when they wanted to go to Rome and view documents there and interview officials there.
Let me say that I know this is an incredibly complicated story to follow, so let me ask you to just sum up what you think the importance is of these revelations of the past couple of weeks about the bank loans and the CIA documents and so on. How important a development is this?
I think that the significance of this dispute between the CIA and the Justice Department is that it illustrates, again, that the Bush administration policy was to help Iraq during this very critical period, and it raises the strong possibility that the U.S. government turned the other way in order to shield that policy. I think that's the most important thing. The second thing that the fact that these documents were withheld does is that it lends credence to the theory that there was an administration-wide cover-up of the extent of its aid here. Now, the B&L case and the investigation of it, Murray and I had already written back in March of 1992, had been delayed by the Justice Department. Defendants had been removed at the request of the State Department. So it was the New York Times that broke the story that the White House had called the prosecutor involved in this investigation at the very beginning of the investigation. So we already saw a level of interference from the Bush administration. The withholding of these documents raises the ante considerably because it shows that there was a possibility of a cover-up here.
Let's look at how this may or may not affect the presidential election. I mean, the president really is campaigning on his foreign policy expertise. How do these revelations affect what Bush is saying about his foreign policy?
Well, this issue is still sort of smoldering as a campaign issue. The Democrats have been slow to pick it up. By Democrats, I mean Clinton and Gore. Democrats in Congress, led by Henry Gonzalez, have been raising the issue for many weeks now, many months. But the Clinton-Gore campaign has been slow to pick it up. But I think that nonetheless, the issue has already had a big impact on the presidential race because what it has done is neutralized the positive benefits of the Gulf War for George Bush. Whenever his campaign wants to raise the specter of that victory to show him as a savvy foreign policy manager, they know they're going to have to confront these questions about the role of the United States and particularly the role of President Bush in assisting Saddam Hussein in the military buildup. That, I think, goes to the heart of why I say this in the story in the LA Times today, why this July 28, 1990 cable from Bush to Hussein is important, because I think it shows that at that time, Bush was still in a conciliatory stance towards Saddam. And if you look at that 5 days before the war, 5 days before he began calling him Adolf Hitler, that raises real questions about just how savvy a political leader George Bush is in foreign affairs, I think.
Al Gore has charged that President Bush's policies actually led to the Gulf War, and Clinton has called for the appointment of an independent counsel to investigate whether the administration has covered up its pre-war dealings with Iraq. And yet you really haven't heard the Democrats talking about the story all that much. Why do you think that they're not making more of an issue out of it during this campaign?
Well, I'm not sure. There have been certainly staffers in the Clinton-Gore campaign. There have been staffers at DNC who've been very interested in this issue, and they've tried to push it at the campaign. I think for one thing, Gore is better positioned to raise this issue than Clinton because Gore, in the Senate, voted to authorize the use of military force. He's a member of the Armed Services Committee. So in a sense, he's got the standing to do it. If Clinton does it, he risks Bush coming back and accusing him of being wishy-washy on the war because of those sort of either-or statements that Clinton has made about the war in the last few months. That may have made them a little shy. They may think that this is too complicated an issue. They've certainly hammered away at jobs and the economy, and maybe they just think this issue is too complicated for the voters to understand.
President Bush said that his pro-Iraq policy was to try to bring Iraq into the family of nations. Might there have been other reasons, too, pertaining to oil or other economic reasons?
Well, we've seen evidence that there were other considerations. Whether they rose to reasons or not, I'm not sure. One of the most interesting memos that we've written about was a March 29, 1989 State Department briefing paper for Secretary Baker, Secretary of State Baker, before he met with the Iraqi Undersecretary Nizar Hamdoun. And in that memo, one of the points that they made was that as part of its approach to the United States, Iraq has begun expanding its oil exports to the U.S. and giving favorable deals to U.S. oil companies. Now, that certainly raises a specter that there was something afoot here more than diplomacy, particularly when you look at the oil backgrounds of George Bush and James Baker, to name just two people. What we found in sort of reporting on and expanding that memo was that during the 1988, 89, and early 90 period, the Iraqis were giving, in fact, a very favorable price on crude oil to American importers. Whether that was, you know, a motivating factor behind this policy or not is still an open question, I'm afraid, Terry.
Secretary of State James Baker has emerged as one of the heroes of the Bush administration. He is the person who has organized the Middle East peace negotiations. He was recently brought in to head the president's campaign. And in the last presidential debate, in the first presidential debate, Bush said that if he's reelected, that Baker would become a kind of deputy vice president and would head up the new American economic policies. How does Baker emerge from this story?
Well, I think he emerges very badly, and I hope that if he does at some point become the domestic economy or czar in a new Bush administration, that he'll do better there than he did on the Iraq foreign policy. The president himself has admitted that this policy failed. Its chief architects were George Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker. And we were talking earlier about how far we could track these intelligence warnings and how much did the president know. That remains uncertain. That matter's open to question. However, what is not open to question is that James Baker knew full well what Iraq was up to, and he still pushed hard to maintain this pro-Iraqi tilt in the face of intelligence warnings and advice otherwise from people within the State Department and outside the State Department.
Where does the story go next?
I'm not sure. I've run into problems with the editors in L.A. over this story because we've entered this sort of zone of fairness where it's hard to get the thing out on the front page if they view it as an attack on the president. And I had this story that was in the paper this morning, which I thought was a real important story to summarize what Bush knew. And it contained some pretty good new information, such as that cable. But it got put inside purposely because, you know, they didn't want us to be perceived as raising this issue. I think that CIA Justice Department dispute is going to play out in the next few weeks before the election because the Democrats on the Hill are pushing that issue very hard. I think this is David Boren doing his bit here for the Clinton campaign. I think Gonzalez is going to have more floor statements, but I think that most of the shoes have dropped at this point. You know, the big picture is out there. People can look at this policy and decide for themselves whether it was a good risk or a bad risk.
Douglas Franz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, as always. Thanks.
Douglas Franz is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's been investigating the Iraqgate story for close to a year. We recorded our interview earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.